Hey everyone, a quick note on this week's show. Out of full disclosure, I recorded this episode on Friday prior to the Senate passing the latest COVID stimulus bill. I will be discussing the draft form of the bill, most of which is in the state I described. The only difference is that the unemployment benefits were kept at $300 per week, but were extended for a longer period of time. I do point out that the bill had not passed the Senate yet, although that has obviously changed, and it actually changed yesterday. Just wanted to point that out to put some context on things. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. What's up, everybody? Welcome to this episode of the Moderate Podcast for Sunday, March 7th, 2021. Glad to have you with us this week. As always, just as a reminder, please remember to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And that's appreciated. If you don't have a favorite podcast catcher, if you listen to us through Facebook or Twitter, do us a favor and go to our website, themoderatepodcast.com. You'll see a link to Podchaser, and you'll be able to rate us there. So plenty of ways to let us know how we're doing. People write to me emails. And so I always appreciate that. And if you have like a blog or a podcast, if you have a podcast you want me to check out, let me know. I do answer messages on Facebook. And I also do respond to emails at host@themoderatepodcast.com. So any way that you can get a hold of us, that's the way to do it. Okay, so we've got a few things to talk about this week. I wanted to dive quickly in, just very, very briefly, into this whole Dr. Seuss controversy. Now, I kind of went back and forth on this one as the week progressed, and I have to admit that I did get kind of wrapped up in the hype of cancel culture with Dr. Seuss, and it did bother me a little bit. But I think that I had to take a step back, and I talked to my wife about it too. And actually, my daughter made a comment to my wife about it, so then they had to talk about it, and kind of she had to explain what that was about. Well, I mean, these are, you know, so the story is, if you haven't heard, that the Dr. Seuss family who owns, the Seuss family who owns the rights to the publication. So it's not like it's this third party company that just bought it. It's actually within his family. So the family are the ones that made this call to pull six of his works from publication. So they'll no longer be published. Now, the timing of it is interesting because March 2nd is Dr. Seuss's birthday, and that is also a celebration of reading for children. I can't remember the exact, you know, I think it's Read Across America or something like that. And so it's just a national day to get kids to read, and that's why they celebrate it. You know, it's not a coincidence that it's on Dr. Seuss's birthday, because he is a lot of times a gateway to kids getting to start reading because of, you know, how the rhyming and the storylines and things like that. You know, a lot of people are like, you know, with Dr. Seuss, but we all grew up with that, right? I mean, I think that anybody that grew up in America is familiar with a lot of his famous works. And I have to admit that there's only one of those six books that we owned. Now, we've gotten rid of most of our Dr. Seuss books. We donated them because our kids kind of grew out of them. So we don't have them anymore, but we only recognized one of the six titles that was banned. And the reason they were banned was because of insensitive, hurtful language used towards minorities or how they were depicted. And so my wife, you know, at first I said, my thought went to, my God, we are making race out of everything. Because when you look at the art in a Dr. Seuss book, it looks like, it doesn't look like real people, right? I mean, they're caricatures of people. And then they have different, you know, half animal, half people looking things and, you know, creatures and things like that. So, you know, they don't really, to me, depict real accurate human beings to begin with. Now, having said that, there are some things that were said in these books that did talk about racial minorities, you know, talking about Asians of people that, you know, those are people that, you know, they come from countries we can't pronounce their name. And then there was some of the artwork they said was depicting white supremacy. I don't think that's where I'm kind of like, all right, come on. If my child looked at that, they wouldn't get the impression that, oh, white people are superior to minorities because a white person's being carried. They don't even look at the world like that. They would have to understand the context of how that used to be the case in this country 100 years ago, 150 years ago, maybe even a little bit, you know, more recent than that. But the point being is that, you know, racism was something that was mainstream, maybe even just 60, 70 years ago in this country. It wasn't a big deal to be a racist. Now, that is such a fringe thing. Are there racists? Absolutely, there are racists. There are. But it's not that people, you know, now it's fringe, and it's by modern normal society, that kind of thing is certainly frowned upon. So I don't think that there should be this rush to, oh my gosh, you know, white people are, you know, back then that was the view of white people. Now that's not. It's not. And we know that it was wrong, and we've evolved from that. Now, if you're going to say, well, that's why we want to get rid of it, okay. But the bottom line is that when you're looking at a kid's book, are they going to get the impression that, you know, we have an African-American family that lives right next door to us here at the Davis household? And do my children even have this idea that because they're darker skinned, that somehow they are inferior? No, because we've never put that in their head. And we treat everybody as the same. I mean, one of my boy's best friends is black. And I know that's what racists say, right? I have a friend that's black, you know. But it's true. But the reason is they're friends is because they just get along. He's part of his running club. And he doesn't look at him any different. Then he looks at anybody else because they don't see the world that way. And we've not taught them to see the world that way. Whereas even my grandmother would say racist things. She said a racist thing to me one time. And it really stuck with me. And so, but that was a different generation. That was a different time. She grew up in a different time in the South, where that kind of thing was normal. Now it's not. And so I feel like when we do these kinds of things, the timing of it is where I'm probably having the problem now. They said they made the decision to stop publishing those 6 books last year. Well, why are we just hearing about it? Why did they time it to make that announcement on March 2nd? It was to get more attention to it instead of just quietly pushing those aside and just forgetting about that past. Yes, I know we need to teach history, and we do, and we teach the fact that the Civil War was fought to end slavery, ultimately. Now, does that mean that, you know, Abraham Lincoln thought blacks were equal with whites? No, that's not the point, but they also knew that it was that slavery was inhumane and it went way too far. Now, did people go far enough in terms of making, you know, African Americans equal? No, it didn't. And that's what happened over the next 100 years or so. And now things are starting to get a little bit better and a little bit better. Now, does that mean that racial inequality doesn't exist? No, it doesn't. Because it does exist. It still does exist. But is that because they're black, or is that because they're poor? There are poor white people as well. But the problem is that, you know, you've seen we've talked about this on the show before. The wealth gap between blacks and whites is really been unchanged in the last, you know, since the 60s, since the civil rights era came about. And so the fact that it hasn't changed doesn't mean we're more racist now than we were before. It's just that we've never done enough to help the poor in this country and pick them up. And if we start looking at it from a socioeconomic standpoint rather than a racial standpoint, number one, I think you'll get more people on board because then it's more of an objective thing. You can look at income levels and that's pretty objective, right? And so, but those programs, if you looked at just trying to serve the poor, those programs would disproportionately benefit racial minorities because they are disproportionately poor. But if you focus the programs and the services and the arguments on socioeconomic status only, and don't mention the fact that this is disproportionately affects minorities and bring that into the equation. If you leave that part out of it, organically, those folks will be risen up. That's the point. And that's the goal. So how we get there is through more objective types of measurements, not through looking at it from a racial standpoint, looking at it from an economic standpoint. That's how that happens. And we're going to talk about the minimum wage later and some of the pros and cons to that, because I'm torn on that on that argument. I think there's merit on both sides of the equation, whether you want to have them or whether you don't want to raise them at all, or whether you don't think they should even exist, or whether you think that maybe it should be somewhere in the middle. Okay. The problem is we've gone so long, is that that's why it's such a discrepancy now. If we had been reasoning incrementally over time, then if we were at $15 an hour now, it wouldn't be a big deal because it would have been, you know, 50 cents here, a dollar here a year. And that's easier to absorb than one in one fell swoop, even over 5 years, because we're trying to make up for this gap of time that we didn't do anything. Okay, so we'll talk about that later. So anyway, I get the Dr. Seuss canceling those books. That's fine. But the right went ape crap on this because now they're like, oh my God, they're canceling Dr. Seuss. No, they're not canceling Dr. Seuss. He wrote hundreds of books. We're talking about six. And all of a sudden, oh my God, we're canceling Dr. Seuss. These are the same people that are looking at the coronavirus deaths, which we're going to talk about in just a moment, that say, oh, well, you know, it's just the flu. We're talking about six Dr. Seuss books, and you're saying you're canceling Dr. Seuss, even though he's written hundreds of books that are still going to continue to be published and are still beloved by most people in this nation, and that kids are still going to enjoy for years to come, versus this, but that is cancellation. But looking at 500,000 deaths, that's not a big deal. That's not a big deal. We're talking about a 15% increase, or actually a 17% increase in the number of deaths compared to in 2020 compared to 2019. Whereas these six books out of hundreds that he's written are probably only a few percentage points of the books he's written. Proportion, people. So you can't have these arguments both ways. You can't freak the hell out about six books and say that someone's entire works are being canceled and that this person's being canceled. We're never going to hear from them again, because that's what they're saying. That's what they're saying. But yet you're going to discount other things because it doesn't fit your agenda. Okay. That is where I've got a problem. It's hypocrisy. It seems like it should change the name of the show should be called Calling Out Hypocrisy, because that's all they seem to do these days. So let's talk about, speaking of coronavirus deaths, let's talk about that. So I'm at a point where I believe that the numbers are pretty final. There are probably going to be some stragglers added to the 2020 numbers because some remote places may be very, very slow to report. But I think that the numbers are close enough to where we can have a real conversation about where they are. So when you look at excess death, and so basically the CDC goes, okay, based on demographic changes, based on these on life expectancy and population changes and things like that, this is where we expect deaths to be. And that's based on averages and per capita deaths and whatnot. So there's, you know, they have this number that they expect to die. And so in 2017, for example, that number, the expected death was 2,905,000. But the actual number of deaths was only 2,811,000. So roughly almost 100,000 difference. In 2018, there were 28,039 more deaths. So the number of deaths went up by 1%. It was 2,839,000 versus 2,937,000 expected. In 2019, there were 13,670 deaths more than 2018 to get that number to 2,852,746. That's a 0.5% increase, a 0.5% increase, versus the expected deaths, which is really high, of 3,044,575, which is kind of a weird scenario. So I think that in 2016, 2015, maybe the death counts were up and they've kind of like went down a little bit. Not sure why the expected deaths would spike that much, because the expected deaths in 2020, before coronavirus hit, was 2,949,980. So they revised those down because they had been pretty far down underneath those numbers. So I think they looked at it and goes, okay, well, if 2,852 died in 2019, 2,949, that's almost 100,000 increase. That seems like it'd be, you know, a pretty reasonable number. And in a reasonable year, we probably would have ended up below that. However, in 2020, we had 3,337,215 deaths. That was an increase of 484,469 people that died versus 2019, a 17% increase. So we did not have a large increase in the population to account for that. So people that are like, oh my gosh, well, they're overcounting COVID deaths, and the COVID death, you know, deaths were no more than the flu. Well, that's not true, obviously. So the number of deaths is real. Now, again, is it disproportionate to the number of people that died? Yes. Is it also a factor that maybe Americans aren't as healthy as their counterparts in some of the other first world nations? So, you know, you look at Europe, although Europe had a lot of deaths too, but, you know, we had a disproportionate number of deaths compared to our share of the population in the world. I think we had about 20% of the coronavirus deaths so far. Now, again, does that mean that we're undercount, that other places are undercounting? That could be. The deaths could be more. You know, I definitely believe that the number of cases is undercounted. I saw somebody in Twitter, though, that said that, oh, no, that means that the real count is like 5 to 10 times higher than the 20 million cases that we've had of coronavirus. It's like, what? So you're saying that there's between 100 million and 200 million cases of coronavirus this year? That means between a third and two-thirds of people had it. I don't think so. People don't know how to do math. But the only way that you can then make the argument that, well, it's no worse than the flu, is to have that number of cases. So it's clear that this is obviously more deadly than the flu. Now, having said that, is it to the level of the Spanish flu? I would say no, because the Spanish flu killed about 50 million people when the world's population was about half, maybe even less than it is now. So obviously, that's not the case. But when you look at, so you look at the total deaths of 3,337,215. When you exclude COVID, the number is 2,974,248. So you take COVID out of it, right? In 2020, this doesn't count deaths that have happened since 2020. So the first 2 months of this year, because we know that the count is over 500,000. So the number of actual deaths in 2020 from COVID was up 387,000. So you can do the math there. So basically, it's the difference between 337 million and 2,949 $2,949,000 versus $3,337,000. So I know that I'm going all over the place with these numbers. So the total deaths excluding COVID were $2,974,248, which is a 121,000 increase over 2019. It was also about 24,000 higher than the expected deaths of 2,950,000. Okay. So now again, remember the actual versus excess was 387,235. So they expected 2,949,000. We had actually 3,337,000. But that's still, again, that's almost 500,000 more than that died in 2019. When the increases in 2018 was 28,000, the increase in 2019 was 13,000, almost 14,000. And then you had an increase of 484,000 in 2020. So obviously, this had an effect. But here's the other, here's the flip side of that. There was a study, and this is where, this is what I've wanted to start to see and have a little bit more analysis on. So this is from the University of California, San Francisco. Under any circumstances, job losses can lead to excess deaths from suicide, substance abuse, and the loss of access to medical care. During the COVID-19 pandemic, however, unemployment in the U.S. has reached highs not seen since the Great Depression, officially peaking at 14.7% in April of 2020. UC San Francisco researchers now have an estimate of how many people may have died as a result of pandemic-related unemployment, a number that adds to the nearly 500,000 deaths that have been directly attributed to the virus itself. Although, again, dying with COVID is not the same as dying of COVID. Now, most people don't die. Most flu deaths are also not a direct result of the flu. They die with the flu. And it's because the flu causes other complications. Either it exacerbates existing issues that you have, or it creates pneumonia, which is a bacterial infection because your immune system's weak and it's affecting your lungs and allows that bacteria to take over, and that's what kills you. And so that is what's happening with coronavirus. It weakens your lungs, so it allows other infections to take hold, and that's what kills people. And that's why older people are more affected, because they do not have as strong immune systems to fight those other things off. So the body's trying to fight this virus off, and in the meantime, all this other crap comes into their body, and that's what kills them. But if they hadn't had COVID, if they hadn't had coronavirus, those things would not have attacked them. So yes, it is related to the virus, because they wouldn't have died if they had not gotten the virus. So that's the other thing that people argue. It's like, oh, well, you know, the number of people that died with just COVID is very, very small. It's like, well, that's the case with most respiratory viruses. Okay, so you know, make sure that you make a distinguishment. So back to this article. The research team, but one more thing I wanted to point out though. They talk about pandemic-related unemployment. No, it's lockdown-related unemployment. So we'll expand on that in a second. The research team projected that the spring 2020 spike in unemployment in the United States would lead to 30,231 excess deaths among 25 to 64-year-olds in the ensuing 12 months. As with the deaths that were directly caused by the virus, those linked to unemployment have taken a disproportionate toll on Black people, men, older people, in this case, workers that are 45 and up, and especially those with the least education. The 30,231 figure represents what the researchers said is their best estimate based on recent studies of the risk of death associated with unemployment, as well as unemployment data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and mortality data from the National Center of Health Statistics during the pandemic. So again, that's where we talk about, that was always the spike that I saw in excess deaths of all of them. That group, that age group, even more so 25 to 44, was what was concerning to me. So they go on, depending on the assumptions that they put into the model, the number of deaths could be much higher or lower. They assume the April 2020 employment, if they assume the April 2020 employment rate was just 10%, and that unemployment was half as harmful as had been seen in the past recessions, their estimate fell to 8,315. But if they assume that unemployment reached 26.5%, which would be the highest estimate using a different definition of who was participating in the labor force, and also that the effects of losing a job in the pandemic were three times as deadly, their estimate rose to 201,968. So again, it's a lot of assumptions, but you have to imagine that a lot of the deaths in that age range were not related to COVID, but related to COVID shutdowns. So this is where one of the researchers said, "We urgently need policies that protect workers and lessen the harms of unemployment, particularly policies that are crafted to support those experiencing the unjust double burden of both COVID-19 and unemployment," which is what the stimulus package is about, which we'll talk about after the break. But one of the things that bothers me about this whole thing is that at least one of the lessons I hope we learn is that we need to make sure that when we look at things like this and we look at it from the perspective of, just the lockdowns and what that prevented, we also have to look at what it caused. And then we have to compare the two. I don't know, again, there's going to be you have to make assumptions on this because there's nothing to look at back in the past that we can compare this to where we have enough accurate data to show the effects of the lockdown versus if we had done nothing. Now, what'll really be interesting to see is with Texas and Mississippi lifting all masking mandates, and also, with Texas increasing capacity in restaurants and get-togethers and things like that, they're getting closest to normal out of any major state. And because of their population, they're going to be a good case study. And if the numbers don't change, if they're not significantly different than, say, California or New York or Michigan, Illinois, these states that have had these mandates and are continuing to have these mandates, that's what we're going to see. Because over time, if you look at states that have been stricter versus states that haven't been as strict, the curves are largely the same. You had the spike initially, then it came down. Then you had the spike in the winter, and then it came down. And it didn't matter what the mandates were in what state, which should tell, to me, that is evidence. And that's something that needs to be explored. Now, I know this narrative, they've bought into this narrative. And that's the fear, is that because Fauci's into this narrative, he's got to do everything he can to defend himself because he doesn't want to be wrong. He's got a huge ego. And, it'd be one thing if, because he worked for Trump, he couldn't admit he was wrong, because that's how Trump is. But he's continuing to do it that way. He's not going back and going, some of the assumptions we made weren't correct, and he's not being humble about it. You would think that under Biden he could do that, more so than Trump anyway. And yet he's not doing that. He's sticking to his guns, which means to me he has just as big of an ego as Trump does. And that's a dangerous thing to have. He's actually an intelligent person. I don't get me wrong. I believe that he knows his stuff. But he's using that knowledge to keep himself relevant. And the fact that you're not just looking out for the best thing, but you want to make sure that you stay relevant and that you're playing with these numbers and keep moving the goalposts is really concerning to me. Is that, are you really giving us the best information? Or are you giving us the information that will keep us listening to you for as long as possible? Because I am starting to suspect that that is the case. I'm skeptical of conspiracy theories, and that sounds conspiratorial. But hell, it's hard to ignore the numbers, and they're ignoring these other data that are showing that states that have done mandates haven't done much better than states that didn't have mandates. So it's like, and if you need to have mandates in certain areas because they're more densely populated, then regionalize them. You don't have to do a blanket statement. somebody in Bishop, California shouldn't have to do the same things as somebody in downtown Los Angeles or downtown San Francisco, because the population density is, that's two completely different areas with two completely different population densities, atmospheres, you know, environments, economics, everything. Okay. And so we see at least some work going into other causes of death during this pandemic that maybe we could have prevented if we had done this correctly. And that's the lesson I want learned. If you know, it's one thing if we do it and then we think that this is the way it should be done versus let's keep the stuff we did right, get rid of the stuff we did wrong. And maybe when this thing kind of thing happens again, because pandemics happen, they've happened throughout human history, so they're going to happen again, then maybe, just maybe, we can be more effective in our, in how we go attack the thing. We can make sure we don't destroy lives unnecessarily while trying to protect the most vulnerable. That should be the balance. That should be the goal. Okay. So I was involved with, I wasn't involved, but I listened to a talk on the state of the economy. So I got an economic update from Chris Thornburg. And he's an economist here in Southern California. He focuses on the Southern California region. And so he was showing us a bunch of economic data that was showing that, just as a lot of people suspected, including myself, and I think I've talked about this before, is that the uniqueness of this particular recession was that, number one, it only lasted for 2 months, believe it or not. We saw decreased economic activity in March and April, and then it's been growing ever since, which would make sense because we caused it. The shutdowns caused it. I mean, you can say the virus caused it. That's fine. But the shutdowns as a result of the virus or are trying to combat the virus is what caused the economic downturn. Because there was, they said, actually the fundamentals in the economy leading up to it were quite strong, whereas during the Great Recession, they were quite weak. So the recession in the early 2010s, from 2008 to 2010, 11, 12, had to do with the fact that demand was down because the housing market collapsed and consumer confidence collapsed and people were over-leveraged. Now we've seen record levels of savings leading up to this. Most of the stimulus checks went to one of two things. Two-thirds of the stimulus money that was paid to individuals went to either savings, or it went to paying down debt. Or a third one was it went to charity. Very few, you know, a very small, relatively small percentage of these the first stimulus checks, right in the middle when everything was shut down, went towards those types of things. And so now we have this other stimulus package, which we're going to talk about after the break, that is maybe not necessary. One of the things that Thornburg pointed out was that in the last recession, yes, the government intervening and putting stimulus can have a good effect if you do it correctly. And back in the Great Recession, he said it was too little, too late. In this case, it was too much, too soon, and now we're talking about more when it's not necessarily needed. He said the only aspect that's really needed is maybe the extension of unemployment, and that's it. Because he showed a graph that showed that, you know, going back to the last two recessions, actual unemployment never rose to the levels even that we saw during the dot-com bubble burst back in the early 2000s, that most of the unemployment was temporary layoffs. So, for example, all the layoffs that happened at Disneyland and all of the tourism-related layoffs, once those open, those jobs need to be filled again, and they will be there, and demand will be there. So the only thing that's holding us back is, number one, these mandates, and number two, people's fears. So as soon as we get past those, we're going to be right back to where we were. That's the contention, because this was not something that was caused by fundamental flaws underlying the economy. this had to do with an external event, you know, kind of like a 9/11 type of thing, where it was a specific event that caused it that didn't necessarily relate to what was the fundamentals in the economy. And so that's why we're still seeing housing activity doing well, consumer confidence is doing well. And so people aren't as bad off as the government would make you believe, that to the point where we need to have another $2 trillion going into the economy. We have money going into, say, local governments. Now, yes, they lost money during that period. Sales tax was down. There was almost non-existent. Property tax really not affected that much. Because one of the things that we noticed where I work was that property tax collections really weren't that as different as they were before. So we're going to talk about that. Actually, you know what? We're going to go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, we're going to go ahead and talk about the stimulus package, what's in it, and also one aspect of it, the minimum wage. I do want to get into that a little bit, even though it looks like it's not going to be a part of the final bill. But I still want to talk about that aspect because it is something that has been talked about for a long time. So we're going to talk about that when we return. This week's episode of the Moderate Podcast is presented by Away Travel. Travel hasn't been something we've been able to do much of lately, but that will likely be changing soon, and you're probably chomping at the bit to get out of town. That's where Away comes in. Quite simply, Away makes everything you need for your trip away. Away started with the perfect suitcase, then built from there, creating a range of travel standards developed from the travel stories of friends and seatmates. The pieces aren't smart, they're thoughtful, with features that solve real travel problems. To give the whole world access to better travel standards, Away took the direct-to-consumer approach to lower prices, and the quality is guaranteed. Your Away suitcase will be with you for life. We are teaming up with Away and Podgo to give you the best deal on premium luggage by going to podgo.co/away. That's Podgo, podgo.co/away. Away Travel, here to make your journey seamless. Welcome back to the Moderate Podcast, powered by Anchor.fm, as we have been since day one of this podcast. So let's talk about this stimulus bill. And again, it's working its way through the Senate. And actually, by the time you listen to this, it may have already cleared the Senate, depending on when you're listening. So let's look at what's in there. $1.9 trillion. Now, that's the number that the House passed, but already changes that we know about are going to cut into that number. One of the changes is who gets stimulus money. So the House version of the bill would get full money to people that make less than or individuals that make less than $75,000 and married couples that make less than $150,000. And then it would start to phase out and would phase out completely by $200,000. Well, they've revised that number from $200,000 down to $160,000. So it would phase out between $150,000 and $160,000. So that because of that small gap, it may behoove people to wait to file their taxes in 2020, because it's going to be based on the higher amount of your 2019 and your 2020 income. So if your income went down, let's say you made $160,000 in 2019, if you went down to maybe $145,000 in 2020, get your taxes in now. But if it's the reverse, if the case is reversed, then I'd wait, because then that way you'll be able to get your money. Now, of course, you got to make sure that you file before April 15th, but that's neither here nor there. So the other thing that the deadline that they're looking for is next Sunday, March 14th, and that's when the federal unemployment enhancement ends. And one of the things the bill will do is it will increase that amount from $300 a week to $400 per week, and it would extend those benefits through, I believe, August. So now, if that's is that the amount of time that's needed maybe, maybe not. My thought on that is, so that you don't have to keep revisiting this, is that you could tie it to some metric, you know, tie it to some, you know, Bureau of Labor Statistics metric that says if we hit this threshold, the payments are subject to end early or they'll go down until then we phase them out in August. Otherwise, they stay, you know, at the elevated amount, because then that way, if the job market is starting to come back and jobs are starting to come back, people will have, then if we lower it, then people have more incentives to return to work. And I think that's what we'd like to see, because if these restrictions are lowered, you know, especially in states like California, for example, that means they're probably pretty safe, because we're taking a very, very conservative, using the word conservative in California is pretty funny, but taking a more, you know, calculated approach, I guess you could say, to the pandemic than, say, Texas. Now, again, do I think that Texas is making the right move? I don't know. I think it's remained to be seen, but I think so. I really do. I think that, you know, they don't have as much, many people vaccinated in Texas as they do here in California. So maybe that'll have an effect. But even with that, their numbers have come down just similarly to California, even though they've had more things open. So again, that goes back to the argument that, you know, the states that have less restrictions are seeing similar data to states that don't have less, that have more restrictions. So why are, you know, what does that tell you? That should say something. It shouldn't be just ignored. That needs to be something that's in the, at least in the discussion. And people seem to want to ignore that piece of it. So these, you know, and the other thing that people are arguing about with this whole thing about, you know, the stimulus checks and the $1,400, and I thought Biden promised $2,000. It's like, no, he promised to make up the other $1,400 to get you to $2,000. But the problem with that, though, is if you're changing the thresholds of who's getting this money, then it should be treated separately. Right? Because, you know, under the old bill, I was eligible for money. And so under this new bill, I won't be. And so I won't get my extra money like some other people will. So that really isn't completely being, you know, making these promises made. And I guess I probably said a little bit too much about my income, but so it would expand the child tax credit. The other thing it would do with the unemployment benefits is it actually would expand who's eligible. So it would include gig workers. So for example, Uber drivers, you know, obviously Uber drivers are going to probably be lower. They probably switch to DoorDash or Uber Eats if they still want to continue to do that kind of thing, which doesn't pay as well from what I understand. It's not as lucrative. Now, one of the things that... let's see, student loan forgiveness is not going to be part of it. It does look like that. I'm prepared to write off the $10,000 debt, but not $50,000. The House bill doesn't address student loan debt at all. So there's that. We talked about the unemployment benefits. We talked about the expanded child care credit. Families could claim up to $3,600 per year for a child six and under, and up to $3,000 a year. So the House bill would expand the child care tax credit, which is $2,000 a year for children under 17. It would extend the benefit to lower income families who wouldn't receive it otherwise. So in other words, it becomes refundable. And so, hey, I'm on board with this because I have three kids. So it would go up for me from $2,000 to $3,000 since my kids are older than six. And then it also addresses vaccine delivery. It would set aside $160 billion for a nationwide vaccine program. So that actually is effective, you know, directly affects that. It would extend the eviction ban through September. Some of the concerns about that are, well, how is this going to help landlords that are not giving income? Well, the plan would provide $30 billion in rental assistance. So from what I understand is that there are programs here in California, at least that they're looking at, that would allow for rent forgiveness, but then it would be subsidized by the state. So in other words, hey, if you forgive 15%, we'll give you the other 85%. So at least the landlords aren't made whole, but at least they'll get something. And I think that it doesn't necessarily allow for those to be written off. It just says that you can't be evicted. So the rent can still accumulate and amortize. Funds to help schools reopen, that would be great. And I like to have my kids go longer. But they enjoyed their first week of school. And then additional money for state, local, and tribal governments. Okay, so as somebody that works for local government, obviously I see firsthand how this pandemic and the lockdowns have affected the revenues of my employer. But on the other hand, what they're talking about is probably too much. So the way this money would be distributed is, and it's no strings attached to this note. Some of it does have strings attached. Other parts of it do not. The parts that do not would basically be allocated to cities according to the CDBG formula. So that's the Community Development Block Grant Program that's administered through the Department of HUD, Housing and Urban Development. And so basically what that would do is every year the block grant program gets funding and it's distributed according to a formula. It's based on population, socioeconomic circumstances of a city. So a poorer city with a similar population to a richer city would get more, but there's a baseline amount that everyone gets based on population. So it would be distributed with that same formula. Well, unfortunately, because of how states are structured, some cities have been more impacted than others. In California, for example, the burden for COVID response has been the vast majority of it has been bared by counties, with the exception of some cities that have their own health departments. So, in other words, the counties were responsible for the logistics of, the rent stuff and for COVID response and testing and vaccine distribution. They're bearing the cost of all of that. So they have a disproportionate amount of costs associated with COVID, which will likely be paid for by FEMA. So the stimulus is more so to make up for lost revenue related to lost sales tax, possibly income tax, et cetera. Income tax at the state level, and some cities and localities have income tax as well. I know that that's the case in other states, not necessarily here in California. But so that is something that I think that needs to be looked at, because the city I work in, we're going to get more money than we lost. And I think that's the case for a lot of places. And that can be an issue, because, when you get this kind of windfall, number one, again, this is borrowed money. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is, it's one-time money. So it's not like it's, you can't make promises to, like, employees, for example, to give raises with this money, because those raises are perpetual. You don't give a raise. You can get bonuses, I guess, but how would that look? You give bonuses to employees, as a result of the pandemic. That doesn't make any sense either. So, I think that employees had to sacrifice during this pandemic. And I think that is certainly should be recognized. And so, you kind of can maybe work some of it that way. But the bottom line is, if you have money that goes beyond what you maybe spend out of reserves, maybe you put it into infrastructure. And from what I understand, infrastructure will actually be something that is addressed in a separate bill later on, which will be another big dollar amount that we're going to be borrowing. And so Chris Thornburg, when I was listening to his speech, when he talked about the stimulus, he goes, "This isn't stimulus. This is an intergenerational mugging." That's what he called this. And so the fact that we did almost $3 trillion the first time around, we're doing another $2 trillion here. That's more than the federal government spends in a year normally. That's how much we're, can you imagine, like, basically going out and, you know, you make $100,000 a year, let's say, and it's a lot of money, right? And then you just go out and borrow $120,000 for just, you know, stuff, just regular old stuff. You know, we do that with our mortgages. Obviously, you know, you buy a $400,000 house or something, you're going to borrow more than your income, but you're paying that over 30 years, right? And that's the theory here. But that's in addition to the money you're spending on a day-to-day basis, which, by the way, for the federal government usually ends up being about the same. They're already spending more than they're taking in, and now they're going to put debt on top of that that they're going to have to pay back over, you know, 30 years probably, because they're issuing they're going to have to issue a bunch of treasury bills to pay for it. So that's where we're going to run into issues. We can run into inflation. And so inflation's been so low that the issue of minimum wage, which was also addressed in the House bill, comes into more of question as to whether or not this is the right time to do it, because inflation has been low for so long. So ultimately, the Senate version will not include it, and the Senate parliamentarian has basically said, no, we can't include this in reconciliation. So, and it shouldn't be. Federal, you know, you want to talk about pork and something that's not really related to the pandemic, this is one of those things. The minimum wage issue has been an argument long before the pandemic. It's going to be here long after the pandemic. So it should be addressed on its own. If you're going to address it on its own. You know, you can still make the arguments about it. And again, this is one that I'm torn on. So I looked into some of the data. I wanted to look at the stats on minimum wage. And one of the first things I asked myself was, well, is the minimum wage even constitutional? And that has been challenged. And it has been found to be constitutional. So the minimum wage has been around since the 30s. It was part of the Great New Deal, part of the FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that provided for basic worker rights, worker protections, and one of the things it did do was create the minimum wage. And the minimum wage, when it first came into being back in 1938, was 25 cents an hour. Now, in 2018 dollars, that was only $3.81. And it really didn't reach its peak in real dollars. So we're going to look at 2018 constant dollars. Its peak was in 1968 when it was in 2018 dollars, the minimum wage was $10.15, which was $1.60 back then. Now, the minimum wage has not been increased since 2009 after a series of increases that brought it from $5.15 an hour to $7.25 an hour. Now, here's the interesting thing. The minimum wage, it's the first increase happened in 2007. It went from $5.15 an hour to $5.85 an hour. Who was in the White House when that bill passed? It was a Republican. And I believe it might have even been a Republican majority in both the House and the Senate when that passed. So a Republican administration was the last one to pass a minimum wage increase. Didn't happen under Obama. As a matter of fact, the current minimum wage of $7.25 an hour went into effect 19 days before President Obama was inaugurated. So obviously, people are trying to make this into like a big democratic socialist type of thing when the last time it was increased was under Republicans. So that's an interesting thing. The other thing is, it has been increased over time. The last time when it was increased in 2007, it had gone, it was $5.15 an hour from 1997 all the way until 2006. And so the minimum wage passage to get it up from $4.25 an hour to $5.15 an hour happened under a Democratic president, but a Republican House. Keep in mind, remember 1994, the contract with America, Newt Gingrich came into power. The Republican House passed minimum wage. So the last two minimum wage increases were passed by Republican Congresses, at least in the House. So keep that in mind too. But the buying power of the minimum wage now has gone down, obviously. Now, the good news is because inflation has been low, it hasn't necessarily eroded the buying power that much over time. They still say it has eroded it by about 9% in this time period. But that's still better than the inflation we saw in the 1980s. That saw it go from the minimum wage didn't increase for like 10 years, during the Reagan administration. It was at $3.35 an hour, but its buying power in 2018 dollars went from $9.38 an hour down to about $6.57 an hour. And the lowest it's been was right before it was passed in 2006, $6.43 was the 2018 equivalent of the minimum wage. So, it's stayed steady and it's increased and we've seen it go up and then go, and then it has slowly come down again. And so it hasn't eroded a lot. But when they look at the buying power, the productivity, the raise, the projected if the minimum wage rose with productivity, it should be at, in 2018 dollars, it should be at $20.34. Now, that's, to me, is a little bit of a misnomer because, number one, the productivity that is provided with low-skill wages doesn't provide as much value, and I'm sorry to say it, but it's just true, because if you provided more value, you would make more money. I mean, that's just the bottom line, okay? I'm sorry that's the case, but that is the case, all right? So, because high-skilled jobs pay more money, but they're also more highly productive, and that's why they get paid more. But if you look at the statistics as to, how many people actually make minimum wage or lower, they've been tracking that since 1979, and the peak was in 1980 and 1981 when 15.1% of hourly workers were making minimum wage. Now, that's not of all workers, that's just of hourly workers. And that number of hourly workers as a percentage of total workers has been very, very consistent over the years. It's been anywhere between 60, let's say, I think the lowest is about 58%, between 58 and 62%. So it's very, very consistent. So you have salary workers and you have hourly workers. So of hourly workers, which made up 58.6% of the workforce, 15.1% of those people were making minimum wage or lower. That number today, and the latest number we have is 2017, is 2.3%. So a much lower number, and it does lower. I mean, as you increase, if you do an increase to minimum wage, that number goes up. Now, during the recession, that number went up, and it went from 2.3% in 2007 up to 6% in 2010. Now, remember, the other thing that happened there is two things. Number one, you had a recession, so people probably had to get lower paid jobs. But number two, you also had an increase in the minimum wage. So that may have, there may have been people that were brought up because the minimum wage went up, but other people that were already above it maybe didn't get an increase. And therefore, a few more percentage people higher got it. So we're at probably the lowest number that we've seen since this stat has been tracked at 2.3%. But if you look at who makes $15 an hour in the US, now again, there are some cities that already are at $15 an hour, so that is minimum wage for some places. Here in California, the minimum wage for large employers just increased to $14 an hour in 2021, and that's going to go to $15 in 2022. So, obviously that's going to skew things a little bit as well. But in 2017, the number of people that made minimum wage was 2.3%. And the study that I'm looking at here from 2015 that talks about the number of people that make less than $15 an hour, it was from 2015. So the number of people at minimum wage or lower was 3.3%. Again, this is the federal minimum wage of $7.25, not just minimum wage wherever they are. The number of people making $15 or lower an hour, 42%. 42%. This is of hourly workers. And so again, because if it was all workers, then that'd be essentially everybody that's not salary, which is a ridiculous number. But so 42% of hourly workers make less than $42 or make less than $15 an hour. So you can see now that the discrepancy between the number of people that make minimum wage and the number of people that make at the current minimum wage, which you would believe would have to increase people's pay above them, right? You can see just mathematically speaking, when you're going to be doubling, more than doubling that number, how that's going to affect the bottom lines of companies. Now, there was an article in Forbes, and again, this is somebody that just is a small business owner, and this is an anecdote. This is some anecdotal evidence of what's going on with minimum wage. A recent study by the Congressional Budget Office entitled "The Effects on Employment and Family Income of Increasing the Federal Minimum Wage" was conducted to determine how increasing the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $10, $12, or $15 per hour by 2025 would affect employment and family income. The conclusion was that increasing the federal minimum wage would have two major impacts on low-wage workers. Earnings would increase for many, which would lift some families out of poverty. However, low-wage workers would become jobless, their family income would drop, and it would place them below the poverty threshold. So those are those kind of in-betweeners, right, that are currently making more than minimum wage. They could potentially lose their jobs, maybe because of automation or other things. So they talk about this in there. So raising the minimum wage has a number of serious and negative unintended consequences. Employers, especially small family and mid-sized businesses, will be disproportionately hurt by the extra costs incurred. The local neighborhood stores and businesses with razor-thin margin profits will be forced to raise prices to make up for the additional labor cost. With the increased prices, customers may elect to take their business elsewhere. Losing customers means losing income, which could result in the business having to lay off workers. Large corporations with big budgets will weigh the increased labor costs and elect to invest in technology to displace workers. This trend will continue to become prevalent in the food industry, food service industry, hospitality, retail, construction, and manufacturing. So then he goes through a rough calculation about what the cost would be, and then there could be a risk of people getting paid under the table instead. They give the example of Seattle. So Seattle's move to $15 an hour a few years ago resulted in workers given fewer hours and experiencing a net loss in pay. Now, here's what they say now about this. With the best intent of intentions, the $15 hourly wage can lull people into staying at a role for far too long. So he gives an example of his nephew. Again, an anecdotal story. And he enjoyed the cash from working at a local deli. Living at home with three room and board, he felt flush with money. 5 years later, he's in his late 20s living in an apartment with his boyfriend, and he has suddenly realized that the money doesn't go so far. Because he stayed at this minimum wage for too long, he's finding that he's not very marketable. There isn't a huge demand for a high school educated person with very narrow food service experience and living in a small town. If his pay were lower, it may have served as a motivation to seek out other work that offers future growth potential. Now, the argument's going to be, well, he's white. Maybe he would have had that opportunity. Minorities don't have that opportunity. That's not necessarily true. But when you talk about people that are older, that are in these jobs that pay less than $15 an hour, you just say, oh, well, go out and get yourself some better skills. Well, how do you do that? How do you do that? Because that requires education. Education is costly. Because even if you go to a junior college, you still have to pay for books, you still have to pay for parking. And then you say, well, give up your other frivolous stuff. You don't have to have internet. You don't have to have cable TV. Maybe you can give up the cable TV. A lot of people are doing that anyway. But you can't give up the internet because you may need that for school. You can't give up your cell phone because you may need that for school. So education and trying to make yourself better does rely on technology. And then if you have to pay to go to a trade school, let's say, there's also payments for that. Now, there are internships you can get and apprenticeships and things like that. But it still doesn't replace the fact that you are need to still bring in some type of income. And then you then the other issue is that we are subsidizing. This is the argument that Bernie Sanders makes, is that, hey, you have all these low-wage workers and we're subsidizing them because they're not making enough to make ends meet and they're on food stamps, they're on public assistance that we are paying for. So because they are not paying enough for their workers, we're therefore making up the difference. That's the argument, right? Whether it's in healthcare, whether it's in food stamps, whether it's in other areas, you know, just welfare. Those are things that we end up paying as a taxpayer. And so if theoretically the employers paid more, then possibly we could pay less in taxes and that would make up the difference. And besides, companies would pay less in taxes because if their expenses go up, they pay taxes on their profits, not on their revenue, right? So if your revenue stays the same, your expenses go up, as long as you're still positive, then you'll end up paying less in taxes. So there's some of that. That's some of the arguments for it. But would we instead of welfare, maybe this is what we should do, and this is what the article suggests. We would better serve this segment of the population if we allocated money to train people to enter areas which there are labor shortages, such as trades. We should offer apprenticeships to learn marketable skills in a specific trade. If a person could learn to become an electrician, carpenter, plumber, heating and cooling professional, or mechanic, they could build a long-term financially rewarding career. Continuing education, computer training, and career coaching would help people too. So, you know, I think that when we talk about student loan forgiveness, that's not maybe the right conversation to have. What you should have is we're going to target that and subsidize the education in these specific areas where we have shortages of workers. That's used to be the way that immigration worked, is that, hey, we don't have enough people in this sector to fill these jobs. Let's bring in highly skilled people from other countries that have those skills, and they could then fill those jobs. Because right now, we actually have a labor shortage. Before the pandemic, we had a labor shortage. There were more jobs available than people to fill them. So that's another reason why I don't think minimum wage really would have much of an effect, because if we're already having trouble hiring, you know, getting enough workers, you have to pay more anyway. So the jobs that are out there can be offering a little bit more. Because the other thing you have to understand is that if minimum wage increases and that closes small businesses, that doesn't mean demand goes away, right? I mean, demand is still there. And actually, it would probably increase a little bit, because if you have people making more money, they'll have more income, therefore more money to spend, which would increase demand. And something would have to come in and fill that demand, right? I mean, if you have too many restaurants, some of those restaurants are going to go out of business. But if you don't have enough and there's a long, long wait, you could probably increase your prices, cut down on that wait time, make more money, right? And you can pay more money. Like you look at In-N-Out Burger, or you look at Chick-fil-A, they pay their workers well. And what will happen is if then you raise the minimum wage, then they're going to have to pay their workers more to be able to continue to attract the good people, because they pay you more, but then they expect more out of you, right? So, you know, the friendliness that you get in In-N-Out at a Chick-fil-A, the work product you get is much better. The quality is much better because the employees are happier. They're more productive. Because if you're paying more than your competitors, you have more of a, you can be more choosy on who you hire, right? You're going to get higher skilled people because there's more demand for those jobs because you're paying more. If I can go make the same amount at a job that doesn't expect as much out of me, why would I have any incentive to go work harder for the same amount of money? So the only thing that then Chick-fil-A or In-N-Out could do is raise their prices too, which would increase prices. So again, there are pros and cons to the arguments, right? I'm going back and forth on purpose. Whether it sounds like, oh my gosh, it sounds like he's for it, and then oh, maybe he's not for it, because that's the complexity of this argument. it's not just a one-dimensional, oh, you raise the minimum wage and businesses are just going to go out of business. Well, no, because demand is still there. But you have to understand that there's not just all this benefit from it. There are consequences to it as well. And is it going to be corporations that are the big winners in this because they can absorb that cost better than a small business can? Possibly. And if you have a smaller number of competitors, that will allow them to raise prices even more. And actually, they could end up being more profitable as a result of this because they have less competition. See how that works? I mean, again, there's so many aspects and so many sides to this argument. And I probably didn't address them all. I didn't hit all on all the high points. But the bottom line is this is something that is going to continue to be argued. And it really goes to show how many people are in that bubble. So you don't have very many people making just minimum wage. But if you increase it to $15 an hour, all of a sudden, that encompasses a big, big chunk of the workforce. And that means that there are going to be real costs associated with that. And there's going to be a domino effect because you're going to have to raise people above them. Because you can't have a manager making the same amount as the subordinate. You can't have that. Why would I want to be a manager then and have that extra headache and have to manage people? Why would I want that if I'm not going to make any more money? So of course you're going to have to increase your manager. You need to have an incentive to take on more responsibility, right? So that's what I'm saying is that you can't just look at the workers that are making less than $15 an hour and just keep it at that because that doesn't work. I mean, there's still other things that have to happen. And then there's costs associated with that. And there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. Some people will lose their job. I mean, you can't get around that because there are businesses that will not be able to absorb that. They just won't. So, and maybe you know, people are like, oh, well, they shouldn't be in business. And, well, maybe that's the case. Maybe that is the case. I don't know. Anyway, that's enough for this episode. We're gonna go ahead and wrap it up. But I think that's something that we need to talk about more. Next week, I probably will get in a little bit into voter ID laws. And those are a big talk right now in state legislatures, and there's a lot of chatter going on about that. If there's any updates to the stimulus package and how it shakes out, we'll give those updates next week as well. So tune in for that. But until then, visit our website at themoderatepodcast.com. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/themoderatepodcast and Twitter at themodpodcast1 and on Instagram at themoderatepodcast on there. And we are on YouTube. We redesigned the website. Also, I did a WordPress website, so I don't think I have my social media links anymore. So I'm going to have to add that at some point. But we are at tinyurl.com/modpodcastyoutube if you want to check out our YouTube channel. We haven't done anything there lately, but some of the stuff we have up there is still pretty relevant and interesting. So check that out. Okay, until next week, everyone stay safe and everyone keep it real.